This is the way it feels to move through summer in Lululemon. Iconic align softness without the front seam. For our smoothest look and feel ever, summer won't know what hit it. Stretch your limits in the non-stop flexibility of the new Lululemon Align No Line Pant in select stores and at lululemon.com.
Psst, your payments are showing. But with Apple Cash, your payments are private by design. There are no public feeds. Send and receive money privately in messages or with Tap to Cash. Switch to Apple Cash. Apple Cash services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail. Companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Victor Christoph, co-founder and CEO of DemoSquare.
I've heard several times people saying, okay, I have this super cool idea. I don't want to share it with anyone until I do it. With me, it was like I had the complete opposite experience. Even when it wasn't completely ready, we were not selling it at all. Just talking about it to people, not even in a professional, in a formal context. You know, you go to a party, you go to a family gathering, you meet with some friends. You just share your ID and you see what's happening. The most important feedback I got came from these informal discussions. I cannot count how many introductions to potential customers I've got through these informal discussions.
This is Victor. He's a fascinating individual with a unique blend of academic excellence, entrepreneurial spirit, and the passion for leveraging technology to enhance democratic processes. He holds a PhD in machine learning from École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne, where he developed algorithms and statistical models to study human behavior within social and political systems. That research became the big foundational idea behind DemoSquare, a SaaS startup that he co-founded in November 2022. Their mission? To democratize democracy by making political and regulatory data more transparent and accessible. It will change the way companies navigate the complex world of politics and regulation, and potentially how citizens engage with democracy. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Victor to my podcast. We explore the journey of transforming academic research into a change-making political data platform. Christoph shares his lessons learned doing customer interviews and pivoting in the right direction. He highlights the value of sharing ideas openly, adapting to constant change, and maintaining resilience in the face of rejection. Last but not least, he offers practical advice on investor relationships, sales strategies, and personal stress management. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how to get a feedback and validate your idea and use both positive and negative feedback to refine or even pivot your product. Secondly, how finding the right co-founder can have a compounding effect on your business. Thirdly, how to stay resilient in the face of rejection from both a customer and investor perspective. And lastly, what to look for in selecting the investors who are going to make the difference for your business. Well, hi, Victor. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
With pleasure, Tony. Thank you very much for the invite.
Yeah, I mean, I saw your announcement recently on an email that I get sort of every day, Strictly VC, and it announced your funding. And then I typically look, okay, what's going on there? What are people doing? And I got intrigued by the mission of the company. Mm-hmm. How companies anticipate political and regulatory change. And I mean, it's a little background for people that don't know me, but I came from the ERP world, and our solution is of course an ERP solution was known for its ability to deal with change. And regulatory change was a big one of that. So I mean, I've always sort of got a weak spot for change because of the
Interesting.
opportunity it gave. Hence I had to invite you because I think it's anticipating political and regulatory change. If you can do that as a company, you're better off. So,
I hope
but
so. I
before,
believe in that.
yeah, but that's how I see it. That's my opinion. But before we start talking about your company, Demo Square, a little bit about you. What drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
Learning and the human experience that I get from the entrepreneurship experience that I'm having. Yeah. I'm learning constantly every day new things. As a founder, as a CEO, you have to constantly adapt to new things. You have to do suddenly 1 week of PR. You've never done public relations before, and you have to announce the first funding round. So you have to spend a week writing press releases, reaching out to journalists. I've never learned to do that. So that's something you have to learn on the go. And I really love that. I really love the learning.
Yeah, well, I mean, same for me. I've been in the industry for a long time. When I left Unit 4, I thought I knew everything, and then I started my own company, and it was like, okay, I know a lot of things here, but not in the rest of what it needs to
Yeah,
drive a
exactly.
business. So I hear you, I feel you when you're talking about these things. But okay, yeah, I mean, you already made a connection there with an example towards PR around the funding. About your company, you started it in November 22. What I read on LinkedIn, the tagline was democratizing democracy. Hence, what I learned from you so far, the name Demo Squared, but about the D in this case. What was the problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution? That
So,
decided you.
yeah, maybe as a very brief background, I'm a tech founder. I come from academia. I did a PhD in machine learning at EPFL in Lausanne, the Swiss Institute of Technology in Lausanne. And my research was about developing predictive models and machine learning algorithms for studying social processes in general, and in particular, political processes. I've always been interested in politics. And at the end of my PhD, I had a few projects that got like enough visibility, and that had some applications about predicting the outcome of elections and predicting the outcome of popular votes in Switzerland. And I applied for an innovation grant at my university and got the grant. It was really early, and the idea was just to explore whether there would be some commercial applications for the algorithms I had developed during my PhD thesis. And so I started conducting interviews and talking to political actors, to companies, to NGOs, to trade associations. And while doing that, at the time, I was more interested in trying to improve the political polling and how you could have better polling, cheaper and more accurate polls. But while doing these interviews, I realized that actually many people and organizations and companies really needed to have a clear and efficient access and understanding of all the political data, the parliamentary data, what's happening in the parliament, what are the upcoming regulations, in what direction is it going to. And so that's how the whole idea got started. And the problem that we saw was, okay, companies need to anticipate future regulations. It's a matter of mitigating risks for them. It's also a matter of identifying new opportunities, new business opportunities. And hence, we decided to build the first MVP of the platform.
Nice. I mean, I like what you say here because it is this sort of balance that has two sides of value, or it's like one coin with on value on the risk side to mitigate it, but also of course the opportunity side. And it, yeah, I completely agree with you. There's a lot of companies always think about, okay, I'm going to save people cost, and they forget to talk about, okay, what is the upside of that? And I think you got a good hook here. Yeah, so you started that from academia. Then starting to build a company. I mean, of course, it's short timing. It's like almost 2 years down the road right now. But of course, like in this world, and I think at that point in time, it was already this whole, you already mentioned generative AI. There was already a big boost around that. So my question would be, like, where did you start? Like, how did you pick your first bets? And
So, can you clarify your first bet?
Well, like, there's so many, of course, ways to start a technology company. So I'm always interested in the things that were fundamental to get right first, that at the end create a differentiation of your company.
So for us, I think the key was to find enough customers, potential customers that were facing the same problem. And then we saw, okay, here, I mean, there is a pattern here. The pattern was just accessing parliamentary data in Switzerland, super niche, super specific parliamentary data even. So we saw this pattern and we decided, okay, let's try to build the first design. It was not even an actual product, the platform. It was just really a mock-up. And let's expose our potential customers to this mock-up, to this design. And you could just see like what a potential platform could look like. It was, of course, not functional at all, but this enabled us to really get early feedback. And our customers were saying, okay, potential customers were saying, okay, this thing looks interesting. This feature, probably not at all. I would love to see this part much more developed and things like this. So this is how we first collected initial feedback. And that's what drove the first development of the MVP.
Exactly. Was it always positive? Like, I mean, how many customers or how many organizations did you have to speak to? Well,
80, I think. We conducted maybe 80 interviews at least. And of course, like, we collected a lot of positive feedback, but also a lot of negative feedback. And that's what's most useful, I think. And maybe one of these feedback was someone who told us, you know, guys, what you're doing is completely meaningless. No one will understand what you're doing and no one is interested in what you're doing. And in a sense, this has been like a source of motivation, you know, to prove this person wrong. And that was maybe one of the most powerful feedback we I got, at least at the time.
Of course. I mean, if your idea is going to be loved by everybody immediately, likely there's already a lot of consensus around what the solution is going to be like, and likely they've already seen something in that direction. So they're used to it. But of course, when it's controversial, when it's ahead of its time, yeah, you're going to get a lot of naysayers there. Yeah, how did you benefit from that? I mean, how did you take the negative feedback and turn it into something that helps you stand out today?
So I think there is two types of feedback, right? There is the, in a sense, quantitative and not really quantitative, but people that tell you, okay, this specific feature, I will not use it. I don't care about this thing. So it's easy. You just ditch it, right? You just don't do it.
Yeah, true.
And then there are people that are more doing qualitative feedback in the sense that they are just criticizing what you're doing, not really specifically on the product, but just a general idea. And again, to me, this is like a source of motivation. You know, let's prove them wrong.
Yeah, exactly. That's fun, huh? Prove them wrong. So like 2 years down the road, almost right now, what has been early decision that appears to be really important for where you stand today? Possibly even like the potential that it gives you for tomorrow.
So yeah, maybe two decisions. First one is, of course, we pivoted several times from the original idea that we had. So you need to be flexible. You need to be ready to adapt to the data you're collecting, to the input you're getting. Maybe the other, and that's probably the single most important decision I've made, was about finding a co-founder. Because at the start, when I was still at the university, I was still in the lab, officially a postdoc, but I was already working on this idea. I was doing that alone. You cannot start a company by yourself. Not at least like a tech startup company. That's completely impossible. So I had to find a co-founder, and I'm really happy with my current co-founder, CTO Jeremy. It's been an amazing decision that we took.
Why is it so important? What have you gained from this?
It's not, you know, when you team up with someone with a co-founder, it's not, you're not adding brains. It's not adding my brain plus his brain. It's a multiplicative effect, right? Two brains together are actually four brains of value in a sense, or even more, you know. And then you just have someone that you can bounce ideas off all the time, someone who you can expose some ideas. You can get feedback on many things that you do. It can be just an email, you know, just want feedback on that. And then you can just improve this email. That's some really simple things, but it can also be much bigger strategic decisions that you have to take. For example, regarding the investment that we got, that's super, super important.
Exactly. So when did you decide to kind of take, well, to go after funding? Because I mean, apparently the funding was recent. So you managed to get through this cycle of at least 1.5 year bootstrapped.
Yes.
What was the point where you said, okay, now it's time to find funding?
The point where we had enough traction, enough customers to see that there was really a big commercial opportunity, but we needed to inject more resources to be able to hire more people more quickly and accelerate on the product and the business development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, you could also say, okay, if there's enough traction with people that are prepared to pay premium for this, as I like to call it, then there's of course also a steady stream or a stream that is steadying towards customer revenue that could fund the business as well. Wasn't that enough?
It wasn't enough. We were not really profitable. We were paying ourselves a very low salary, if at all. We spent several months without paying ourselves salaries. So yes, that's true. We could have decided to try to really get more customers and increase a bit our salaries, but we would never have been able to hire people right now. It would have taken maybe 1-2 years more, and we wanted to be quick.
Yeah, exactly. So what was the speed part? Is that because the market is, it's the race to the top, like the one who owns the market owns it all, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think maybe it's also related to learning, you know, because when you get an investment round, you start working with investors, it really pushes you to another, to the next level, in a sense. It changes completely the scope of what you're doing. It's not just you and your co-founder or your co-founders. You are able to hire some people. You are able to get some office space. We were not anymore working at home or in the university lab. It's really pushing you to the next level. And this means learning more and new things and more and better things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's well, based on the funding that you get, of course, there's new expectations that you have to meet.
Oh yes, yes.
So, I mean, in relation to that, how has that changed your life from there onwards? I mean, what is the biggest change from a couple of months ago and right now for you and for your co-founder?
Maybe I must say, so we just closed the round, we just announced it. It's still very early. We still haven't, the new hires that we have, they haven't joined us yet. We are really in this transition phase at the moment. But we are already trying to anticipate a bit what's going to happen. And for example, next month, we have the first engineers joining us. So it means doing more management. You know, I've never learned to do management. I've managed student projects when I was a PhD student myself. I've never managed people. So that's going to be interesting. You know, we also had our first board meeting 2 days ago with our investors. That's also something you need to learn. That's something you cannot learn if you before doing it once or twice or even several of them. So that's going to be interesting times.
Yeah, well, it's definitely is. And like you say, I mean, luckily enough, you're curious and you love learning and experience that, because otherwise it was going to be a nightmare. In the pre-conversation that we had, one thing that you shared with me that intrigued me, that because this is a relatively, well, for me, it's a new idea. I mean, I hadn't heard about this type of direction and solution direction before. You said many early entrepreneurs that have an idea are reluctant to share it. And you think exactly the opposite. Why is that? What have you experienced?
Yes. So I've heard several times people saying, okay, I have this super cool idea. I don't want to share it with anyone until I do it. With us, with me, it was like I had the complete opposite experience. Yeah. Once, even very early ideas, even when it wasn't completely ready, we were not selling it at all. Just talking about it to people, not even in a professional, in a formal context. You know, you go to a party, you go to a family gathering, you meet with some friends. You just share your idea and you see what's happening. Even with people that are not in the industry, that are not potential customers or even potential users, just share it and you see what's happening. And I think probably the most important feedback I got came from these informal discussions. I cannot count how many introductions to potential customers I've got through these informal discussions. You know, our market is the one of public affairs. That's the title of the people we're trying to target. Anytime, every time I mention this term, my friends, the people I was talking to, they were saying, oh yeah, but I know this person who works in public affairs at company X. I can connect you with him or her. And that's absolutely amazing, I think.
Let me make a small interruption here. Victor just made an excellent remark about his approach to accelerate execution. He's selling the idea, not the product. He realized telling stories in informal ways is a great way to test the validity of his venture. Do people get it? Does it resonate? Does it stick? Not only did it help him to make the idea more concrete based on feedback, it also enabled him to open doors that otherwise would have remained closed. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They are second to none when it comes to creating momentum and have an infectious curiosity. It allows them to start conversations and enthuse others to spread the word for them. They realize ideas are cheap. Ideas that are executed upon are the ones that create a change that we're all waiting for. So the sooner you start doing that, the bigger your advantage. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. It is, exactly. It's the whole thing of the talk trigger. I mean, in my domain, of course, when we're repositioning software companies, what you want to come up with is at the end a very simple explanation, and then people ask you, okay, hey, what do you do? Or what are you up to? That you can translate it into a little story that where people indeed get that Rolodex moment. Even if they have nothing to do with your domain, that they still get that point of, but I know someone in this place and I can introduce you there. It's fantastic.
Because I agree,
if you get it to that simple level, and I think what you've done also here is sort of socializing the idea, and actually by doing it once, twice, three times, 10 times, it will come out in a much simpler way. And at the end, that's where the magic happens, because that is something that you can replicate and it's memorable. So yeah, well, fascinating that you're saying that. And I completely agree with you. If you have an idea, I mean, ideas at the end are cheap. Everybody has ideas. It comes at the end down to the point of your ability to execute, to make the idea come alive.
Exactly. Yeah. Cannot agree more.
So in that journey of bringing the idea alive in the last 2 years, have there ever been a moment where you got stuck?
All the time. You get stuck all the time. And you need to learn how to overcome these obstacles. You need to be flexible, to adapt yourself constantly, every day, every single hour. I can share a fun story. I don't know if it's fun. We've found the first three engineers that are going to join us next month. This morning, and I'm not lying, this morning we got an email from one of them. He decided not to join us. You know, contract was signed. Everything was ready. We were supposed to start in a month. He's not joining us. It's an important position in the company. We need this position. We needed this guy. So what do we do? So an hour ago, I posted a job ad on LinkedIn for this position, and hopefully we'll find someone. But unexpected things happen all the time, and you need to adapt and be flexible, and you need to have a plan, and you need to be ready to adapt this plan all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, like just before we started the call, you mentioned something that sort of, how do you say that? Is two things that I'm actually meaning the opposite of each other. You said something around rigor and flexibility, to be rigorously flexible.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
I mean, that is memorable in itself. So how do you go about it?
Yeah, again, you need to have a plan. You need to set up strategy to make an execution plan and be ready to change it and change the plan and have maybe several options for everything that you're, every decision that you make. You need to be ready to change it and to reverse it the day after. Yeah. And that's also what's part of the entrepreneur life, and also what's make it fun, and that gives you the adrenaline rush.
Yeah. But what is inspiring here, because I like your focus, you know, and my book, The Remarkable Effect, trade number 7 is Remarkable Software Companies Focus on the Essence. That I think where the rigor is coming from. The point is at the end always, yes, you know, you have a plan, you know how to go there, you've created the steps And of course, there is no map, so it will always change a little bit. And there will be positive things happening, negative things happening. So the question is always, like, when do you decide to adapt? And when do you decide to stick to it? Have you got an example of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Nothing comes to mind, actually.
Okay, but I mean, it's if anything comes to mind, that's always good. But yeah, that's where the balance hides. I mean, I've heard, and also to your point, that I mean, the 80 interviews and so many people telling you this is not going to work, and you stuck to it because you believed in it. I think that is maybe the part about the rigor to just prove the opposite.
That's also, you know, to me, it also boils down to resilience, because you're constantly under stress. You're constantly facing rejections, customers saying, you, no, I'm not interested. Investors telling you, no, I'm not interested. People telling you what you're doing is bullshit, you know, and you need to stick to it. You need to be resilient. You need to be able to accept that and to move on as quickly as you get the rejection. You need to move on.
Yeah, true. Exactly. Yeah, resilience is a big word as well. I mean, I just talked about my first book, The Remarkable Effect, and I'm actually working on a second one called Remarkable Resilience, Business Resilience.
Yeah, I see.
No, but you're right. You know, resilience comes in many things when it comes to a business. You know, there's crisis after crisis after crisis. And the art is, first of all, not to die, to sustain. Mm-hmm. But the ideal thing is, at the end, coming out stronger from it. Have you got an example of the hardship that you had to overcome that actually made the business stronger?
Maybe related to the investment round, right? It is so difficult to fundraise, especially in the current market conditions, right?
Exactly.
And you face so much rejections, you face so much criticism from investors, potential investors. Even when we found our lead investor, we had to find a co-investor. And this was also a nightmare. We also had, I don't know, 50, 60 pitches in front of VCs, and only one in the end committed, right? So yeah, you need again to be able to accept the rejection, to move on to the next one until you find one. And in
what
the
did
end,
you learn from that? What did you change in the process?
I think just the fact that it was okay. If an investor says no, it's okay. You have a list of 100 investors you can reach out to. You just go to the next one and you forget about the previous one. Maybe you can reach out to this fund again in the future, right? You never know. You never know also what really motivates their decision. You always have a lot of... a bunch of explanations. Often it's pretty generic. You never know if you have internal conflicts or whatever it can be. So we don't take it personally and just move to the next one.
Exactly. Was there anything specific or special about the investors that betted on you that was different from the others?
So we have two investors, one based in Switzerland, that's the lead investor, and one based in Germany. What I really like is that they are both very complementary. One is a small fund based in Switzerland, very agile. The other one is a massive fund in Germany. They have a lot of credibility and history of making great investments. So working with the two of them is for us super, super interesting. And the investment managers in both funds, they have a lot of experience and they are helping us a lot. We are learning a lot from them as well. They are very supportive, and that's, again, super, super important and very satisfying.
Great to hear that. Of course, the future will tell. So now it's up to... This is a long-term marriage.
Yes, exactly, exactly, yeah.
And you have to get a few... You're in it together right now, and it has to become a success. So knowing that, of course, you're going to get more people, but there's also going to be more... kind of higher barriers to kind of bridge. Mm-hmm. Have you got any frameworks to how you get things done?
I'm using bullet journaling to actually implement the getting things done framework. So okay. I'm getting all my to-dos in the bullet journal, and that's how I organize myself day after day. And I really like it. I really like the getting things done framework, the way you have to set up your tasks. how you collect inputs in your so-called inboxes. Really like how it's working. And I actually love the Pomodoro technique. It's constantly running on my computer, and that's how every day is for me. I mean, when I'm not in the meeting, I just have my my countdown, 25 minutes countdown until the next break, and I that's how I get productive, I think.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I think it's going back to this the thing of focusing on the essence, and that is, you know, you only have 24 hours in a day. You don't want to use the 24 hours in full for pure business. So, yeah, it's about getting things done. What I'm interested in right now is you switch a little bit towards you go to market. Getting towards your first 10 customers, what did you learn from that?
I learned selling. I'm not a salesman by essence. I've never done that before. So I think it was very rewarding to be able to sell the first subscriptions to our platform, to be able to go once. The first time we went through this whole process of reaching out to someone until getting the money on our bank account, that felt really good. And we learned a lot in this process, and now we are able to replicate it and we are able to increase the sales. Of course, there's still a lot of things to do. We have a lot of things to learn. The process is not completely in place today. We need to adapt it again. But still, being able to do it once was extremely rewarding.
Yeah. So was there one particular thing that stood out that you learned?
Not particularly, but I don't know, maybe just being able to convince someone to transfer their money from their bank account to your bank account. that was something super, super interesting. I had never done that before. So
what made them decide, okay, we're going to bet on you? Because, I mean, if you're starting, of course, for a company, it's a small company. A solution that is we're likely one of the first. Of course, typically you're in the innovator space. What made them decide, okay, this is it?
Probably because we had, I think from day one, we started working on the design of the platform. We had these mock-ups earlier, and then we turned that into a product with a strong focus on the design and have a cutting-edge user interface, a cutting-edge user experience. And that's something that systematically comes back in the discussions that we have. And I think one of the main driver of the decisions of our first customers was, okay, the product looks serious, the product looks modern, it's efficient, it will provide me value.
Yeah. These are good things to get back from customers, particularly the value part. Because they have to believe in it. It's like the money they put in will come out multiple times, and ideally in the shortest amount of time. Are you continuing this process of having design partners in development, whereby there's a constant back and forth between customers about what you build, what you don't build, and how you build it?
Yes, definitely. So we don't have like a real process for that, but we have a designer in our team since day one. And we are conducting this when we're conducting these customer interviews, it's also the best way to collect early feedback. And then once a company has turned to be an actual customer, you need to reach out to them and make sure that they are still happy. And if they're not, what's missing? And we are trying to collect this feedback a bit all the time. And this feeds our Notion pages, and we use that to organize and prioritize what will be the next feature that we're going to develop. And that's, I think that's very, very important.
A lot of founders I've heard talking about, we have to do the hard thing first. And doing the hard thing first was required in order to first of all, make something that creates the value that they promise, but it also created differentiation power. And that's durable. Other founders I've heard talking about, okay, no, we go the minimum viable product route. We build something and we build something from there onwards, and we'll take it from there. What is the route that you're following?
It's a bit of both, maybe. I think we like to push new features out as early as possible. I like this concept of having a tracer bullet. You know, you release a feature from end to end. Even if it's not complete, if you don't have all the branches of this feature, you just have it out and then you can build on top of that.
Yeah.
But it's a mix between an MVP and a prototype and an actual feature. And then you see if people like it, then you can develop it more. If they don't like it, you just remove it very easily. But I also like the fact that whenever we feel we face a problem, I don't know, a data source that's very difficult to collect, for example, I love it because it means that we are going to provide even more value to our customers. Because if they have a problem accessing this data source specifically, it means that it's important, and the harder it is for us, the more value it will provide them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and the idea is at the end, of course, to stay resourceful in order to pick up on those things that are, going to provide the most value. It's always a mix. I mean, I've been in this role myself, and there's always 100 things you can do. Pick the ones that are going to be most valuable for the customer, but also business wise. And that's where the art, of course, resides. Looking at the time, on your journey right now for about 2 years, what is been a lesson that you've learned that you love to have known before about?
Flatten the curve, I would say. At the beginning, it was an emotional roller coaster. It's still an emotional roller coaster, but you need to learn to flatten this emotional curve. When you have a good news, at the beginning, we were so happy. We were screaming it out. We were telling it to everyone we met. And then we had a bad news, and we were about to quit and to cancel this whole project and find a job, you know. And at some point, you need to accept that, okay, we've talked about that already earlier in this podcast, but lows are lows, and you need to be resilient and to move on. But also highs, it's nice to enjoy the good feeling that you have. We got the news for the investment round. We were super happy. Of course, we told it to all our friends and family, but then you need to refocus again, and you need to go to the next step. So I like this idea of learning to flatten this emotional curve. Not completely flat, of course. You need to keep it a little bit bumpy, but that's the best way to be resilient. Yeah.
I like that, because I mean, a lot of times also with decisions or with answering something, take a step back. Wait for about count to 10. Wait for a sleep a night over it and so on.
Exactly.
Have you got anything that works best for you in order to not get completely nuts?
So what you just said, actually, sleeping a night over something, I have to do that constantly for every decision. I like to digest it for at least a day. Except from that, I think being able to manage your own stress, because being an entrepreneur is stressful. You're constantly under stress, especially when you have investors, right? So to me, doing sports, seeing my family, spending time with my friends, I run a lot. I bike a lot. I do yoga. I dance. I do a lot of physical activities. I think that's really essential, and that's really key if you want to be ready for this marathon of having a startup company, of building a startup company.
Good that you make a point about that it's a marathon. It's never there's no shortcuts, and it's you sometimes see these overnight successes, and then you realize when you pull up the curve, it has been something like 10 years going on before that. From what you know right now, what advice would you give people listening to this podcast right now, a do and a don't?
A do, to me, it's again about resilience. Learn to be resilient and find your own strategies to be resilient and to be able to stay up for this long run. That's key. Like you said, I think you need to be able to keep it running for a very long time. So
that was a do. Mm-hmm. What about a don't?
A don't. Don't do it by yourself. I think that was one of my first mistakes. I wanted to do it by myself until I found my co-founder. And that was just too difficult. Without him, I would have just quit it, found a job, and I wouldn't be here. So find a good team.
Well said. Well, thank you very much. Where can people go to find out more about Demosquare or to say hi to you?
So yeah, you can just connect demosquad.th, reach out to me, to my email on LinkedIn, victor@demosquad.th, LinkedIn, Victor Christoph. Happy to have a chat with anyone.
Perfect. Good. Well, thank you very much. Good luck on the next part of the journey.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Keep an eye on you.
I hope so. Thank you very much for the invite and keep in touch.
It was a pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Victor. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Victor Christoph, CEO of DemoSquare. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas. And that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the remarkable effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.